on the wall. And the men of Tekoa, they were working on the walls, but their nobles weren't any help. You could see him as he was seeing these activities day by day and as he was writing these things down. And so maybe a question, you know, Nehemiah made a great effort to write a journal about these events right here. But what exactly is the significance of that to us? I mean, there are a number of people that write a daily journal, and most of it is just stuff that's important to us. Is this just important to Nehemiah? Or what does it mean to us? What do you think about that, Earl?
We all have work to do. We're not all doing the same thing. You may be doing one thing, and he may be doing something else, and she may be doing something else, but we all have work to do. There's plenty of work for everybody to do.
You know, whenever we read through Scripture, there may be some times that we read a portion of Scripture and we think, well, what does that mean to me? Or what is that about? Why is that important? And maybe there's some things we kind of struggle our way through on that. But you know, in time, the more you study and as you go through the whole text, you start to realize, well, what was said way back over there, that kind of is important because it applies to this over here. And sometimes when you read through chapters like this right here, which is more or less just kind of a narrative, here's what I saw happening every day. And on one hand, while it may not seem real important to us, on the other hand, God has put nothing in his book that's unimportant. But there's some points we can pull out of it. We see the teamwork aspect of what was going on. And we see how there were people that came to the city to do the work that I believe God would have them to do. And we can see that there was ownership, so to speak, in the work that was being done. And so when you start looking at chapter 3, and you work your way through reading all those names two or three times, you start to realize there is a reason for this. There is a purpose for this. You know, there are some interesting things like that. There's maybe just some significance like, why are the priests the first ones mentioned? Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priest went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. Chapter 3 begins that way. Why are the priests mentioned first? Is there any reason for that? Does that tell us anything? The priests have been God's spiritual leaders. Now, it seems as though there's been little happening in Jerusalem, though there's been efforts now to reestablish, you know, the worship to God. Ezra tells us more even about that. But I think it's interesting that the priests are the ones kind of leading the way here, it seems, on the rebuilding that's taking place. God has always used the priests as leaders.
Think
so. I think that's a good point. Are we stretching it too far to make the point and to realize that as Christians, we are the priests and we have work to do? There's a spiritual work that we have to do as well.
You know, the priests, as far as I know, were not typically masons. They're just like some of the other people, like Hananiah was a perfumer.
Right.
Well, a perfumer is a it maybe is his career, but he wasn't a mason by trade.
Right.
But it's interesting.
And now he's building a wall.
Now he's building a wall, right. In other words, these men were not all masons, mm-hmm. but there was a job to be done. And when there's a job to be done, you become what's needed for the job,
right.
If you're submissive to God.
If you're willing.
And if you're willing, right. Yeah. Like, you know, and an application for us, I never would have, in my youth, never would have perceived that I might become a teacher, or any, and other people might not think of themselves as a teacher, But when the opportunity and the need arises, you become something that you didn't think you were. So they didn't think they were masons, but they became masons because that was
that's what was needed.
Right.
It's interesting. You're right, because you know, as we go on through the text, we find, I don't know, half a dozen or more different occupations, so to speak, merchants and perfumers and goldsmiths and things of this nature. I mean, some of it maybe being somewhat delicate type work. I'm not sure how much hard work a perfumer does. I really don't know. Or goldsmith, they're working on maybe little stuff like that. And now they're moving big blocks. You know, so maybe it's not what they were trained to do, but there was a willingness to get it done. And it seems that they could all see and understand that there was a need of accomplishing this task. And too, I think Earl makes a very valid point that this goes beyond just building the physical wall of Jerusalem. You know, this has been recognized, long recognized, as the city of the Lord. His presence had been there. And there's a spiritual connotation to that. And there seems to be some interest in trying to restore that.
In line with that, I was thinking, what's a wall for? A wall is to keep out the enemies, the evil. Mm-hmm. They had a physical enemy that was trying to attack them.
Yeah.
We have a spiritual enemy, and that is trying to attack the spiritual people. Protect one another in that kingdom, I think. That's an application.
I think so. I mean, the idea that all are involved, not all, but many at least are involved. We don't know who wasn't involved necessarily. But many are involved, and some who have come, it seems, either from not just the city, but even from outside the city, have come to help do this, you know, is pretty amazing, you know. Yeah, it's a physical wall to hold out the enemy, but at the same time, it's the hold in those who are spiritual. There's two sides to that wall. All right, good thoughts. Okay. What comments would you make about these statements here? In the bottom part of page 7 here. What comments would you make about these things? Workers repaired the wall, and next to him, more workers. Hey, let's see if we can just kind of read here a little bit. We've read some of the chapter already. Let's go to about verse 6. We're just going to kind of work our way through, and we're going to try to pull out some points. What is this next to him that's mentioned time and again? And we find that Baruch zealously repaired a section of the wall, and the men of Tekoa repaired another section of the wall. Thinking about some of these things here, we read a little bit here, beginning of verse 6. The Jesniah gate was repaired by Jehoiada, son of Peshiah, and Meshullam, son of Besiodah. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Next to them, repairs were made by the men of Gibeon and Mizpah, and Mataliah of Gibeon, and Jadon of Meronoth. Places under authority of the governors of the Trans-Euphrates, and Uzziah, son of Harahiah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired the next section. And Hananiah, one of the perfume makers, made repairs next to that. They restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. And Rephaniah, son of Hur, ruler of the half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section, joining his. Jedidiah, son of Haramoth, made repairs opposite his house. And Hattush, son of Hashabaniah, made repairs next to him. Next to him, next to him, next to him. As you go through the chapter, you see that, I think it's 28 times if I count it right. 28 times or something like that. And next to him, Benaniah is working. And next to him, Jehoiada. What's the significance of that? I mean, what are we supposed to pull or infer from that?
Together.
That they're working together. Okay? We see that. It becomes a very obvious point that they're working together. What else can we see from that?
It seems to me like they worked in areas that they were near or familiar with.
Another interesting point. As you read on in the text a little bit more, some were repairing the wall opposite of their place or opposite of their house. That's an interesting point, too.
Maybe they had somebody organized it.
You know, something, somewhere, somebody put some things in order. Was that Nehemiah? Was it some others that he had set in place to be the supervisors? I really don't know. But, you know, if you have a group of people that come together, you know, to do a job and say, okay, we're going to build this house right there, something tells me that that's not going to work real well if that's all the instructions that's made. Someone is going to have to give instructions. You know, when we built a couple of houses a few years back, and the first house we built, Brian Haygood was kind of the builder, but my crew was bigger than his crew. I had 12 people one day, friends and family that had come. We were going to frame up a house. He had three. And he says, I've never had a crew this big. I'm not sure what to do. And I said, it's simple. Don't you touch a hammer. You're the boss. You tell us what to do. And he spent the next 3 days as we're framing up this house, going from one side to the other and saying, you work on this, you do this, you do this, you do this. And he'd come back around and he'd have more instruction. That's all he did all day for 3 days. And, I mean, if we all just picked up hammers, we wouldn't have gotten very far because someone had to saw the lumber. Someone had to measure and put some marks on the floor. You know, there was different jobs that had to be done. I don't know exactly how things were organized in Jerusalem and who put all that together. But I do think it's interesting that you have these who are working, and next to them were some more, and next to them were some more, and next to them were some more. Somebody had organized that. And the fact that it seems, as you get in the latter part of the chapter, it becomes a little more apparent to me that there were those who were working next to their house or opposite their house. You know, that, well, what would be important about that? Or what would be significant about that? What do you think, Dave?
You probably take more pride in what you're doing because it's right beside where you're living.
That's kind of what I was thinking. You know, that if you're working on something that's right next to your place, you might have a little more personal interest in that. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. Instead of taking somebody and putting them on the other side, you know, of the city working, they're working next to their place, and it would be convenient too.
Not only that, they also have the encouragement that it's protecting their home.
Right.
And also, it crossed my mind that it's also more efficient. They don't have the travel time.
Sure.
To go over there.
Sure. It's just smart. Yeah.
Since they only work during the day.
That's right. That's smart. Another thing, yeah.
I've been in construction for a number of years, and there's a phrase that I cannot stand that I hear people say sometimes, that is, you can't see it from my house when they're working on something. And the point is, it doesn't have to be nice.
Yeah.
Because you can't see it from my house. And I know that's not the way we do this around here.
You know, coming from the, you know, industrial trade and mechanics trade and stuff like that, you know, if you're working on a machine and you got to put a bolt in, you can put it in right, or if it's a little bit tough, things aren't lined up, you might get a bolt cross-threaded, you know, just chews up the hole and, you know, the threads, and you might get it in, you know, but the next guy that works on it is really going to have a problem when you start working on that. And kind of a similar thing, Rick, you know, I've added to some guys, it's like, man, that thing looks like it's cross-threaded. It's still threaded. You know, I got it in there. You know, like, that's all that matters. Next guy's problem, you know. That's not the way to do it. And so, yeah, having some personal pride in the activity means something.
So I have just a quick question. So all this destruction, this is from the Babylonian conquest.
Yes.
And then 70 AD.
Yeah, after the temple was rebuilt and the city was rebuilt, so in 70 AD, destroyed, not a stone left on a stone, you know, the destruction of Jerusalem. And really, truly, what goes along with that is, I believe, the end of the nation of Israel in a very dramatic way, in the sight of God. Yeah.
400 years between.
Yeah.
400 plus years between this and.
In that. Yeah. Yeah. 400 or a little more at this point, probably, but. Yeah, so, but it's sort of in the account of history as a whole, the total destruction of Jerusalem is kind of in sight, really, isn't it, when you think about that? Because very soon here, we're coming to that point of God's 400 years of silence, where he had nothing to say to his people. I take that as he was really mad. You know, he had already said, there is no remedy. I've had it with you. 400 years, he didn't say anything. And that period of time is coming up before very long, in chronologically.
Just one other thought about building the wall and being next to one another. They didn't just build an individual wall. They had a seam where their wall stopped and a seam where the next one. There was overlap
on
the work, and there had to be.
Right.
I think spiritually speaking, you see that as well.
Well, that's a really good point. You know that, I mean, you have the men of Tekoa working on this wall here, and Jehoiada is working on this wall right here. Somewhere those walls have to come together. And for there to be any strength, the walls have to overlap, the bricks have to overlap. You know, and so there's, which would imply that there's working together to get that done. That's a good point. So, you see, there's some interesting observations that can be made from a somewhat difficult chapter, you know, to read through here. You know, you find such things as Baruch zealously repaired another section. And he'd already been mentioned, that was in verse 20, he'd already been mentioned earlier in the chapter about repairing a section. Now he's going on to do another. I mean, he was zealous about this work and getting it done. You know, it's good to see enthusiasm, you know, in working like this. Some of you have heard me say sometimes, momentum breeds momentum. You ever notice that? I mean, when there's some good things happening in an organization, sometimes the challenge is keeping that enthusiasm and momentum going forward, because momentum breeds momentum. It just kind of works that way. And maybe that's a little bit of what's going on in Jerusalem. I mean, everybody is busy about this task. All around the city. You know, the wall is, it's not like just one section. We'll move over here and we'll move over. No, the city walls all the way around the city are coming up. And momentum seems to breed momentum. Even though there is going to be some obstacles that are about to come upon them. We already had some. But there's greater obstacles about to come upon them. And it's not going to stop the progress on the walls. I mean, they're so enthused with this, they're so engrossed in this, that they're going to keep on moving forward. Paul said to the Galatian brethren, "But it is good to be zealous in good things always, and not only when I'm present with you." In Galatians chapter 4 and verse 18. An interesting reminder for all of us, really, that there's some things we need to be involved in. The things that are good things, and making reference to things of God, it's good to be involved in those things. And in the case of the Galatians, he's saying, not just when I'm with you, but when I'm away, when I'm gone, you know, you should be zealous about these things. Look in Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2. Verse 11. "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us, that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works." I like the passage in what it's describing. You know, in so many ways, the character of those who would be the people of God. And if we are intent on being the people of God, it would just seem to me that we would be the ones most interested in knowing and understanding and doing His will, and not just kind of making our way about it and plodding our way through life, but instead being zealous about being the people of God. Being zealous, recognizing that we are the ones redeemed. Being zealous, understanding that we are the one that he recognizes as his own. And that becomes a motivator for us. And so it's interesting to me to see that there were some who worked just zealously. Perhaps it's an indication that there were some that were just absolutely intent on doing this because it needed to be done. The men of Tekoa repaired another section of wall, verse 27 says. You know, that they're mentioned, I think, around verse 5, you know, as building a section of wall. And what was also said is that their nobles didn't put their hand to the task. And so they're sort of the leaders of the men of Tekoa, you know, were very busy about this work. They were engaged in this, even though their nobles were not. I don't know why their nobles their officers or whatever that may be. I don't know why. They're just obstinate about it. They weren't concerned about God's will. They thought it couldn't be done. You know, there's always those, you know, we'll never make it alive, you know, kind of thing. You know, it can't be done. You always have that. Always you have that. And is that what these men were like? I don't know. But what's interesting in verse 27, the men of Tekoa repaired another section of the wall. That even though their officers were not involved, their nobles were not involved, it didn't matter. They were focused on doing the wall, and they got their section done, and they went and did another. And that's encouraging to me. Oh, yeah, that's another thing, too. It's kind of like, yeah, you'll pick up that brick over there. You know, they're a little too good to be doing that themselves. You know, maybe that's what it was. I don't know. You always have a little of that, too. Yeah. Well, on page 8, we kind of are in the back of your page there. Some more making application, so to speak, from the text. You know, we've made mention this perhaps, there are always some who are anxious to be or to claim to be leaders. You know, there are some who would always be ready to say, hey, I'm in charge here, or, you know, I'm the leader of this group. You know, and some just aspire, you know, to that kind of thing. But words, just saying, you know, I'm the leader here, really doesn't make someone a leader. In fact, there are some who think of themselves as being leaders that really ought not be. The personality's not there, or the mindset, or the ability to lead is just not with them. And they would be much more productive being a follower. And that's okay. There has to be leaders. There has to be followers. And there's a very big difference. This little graphic here on the side, I saw this. I've always kind of liked this. There's a real big difference between a boss and a leader. You know, a boss kind of, you know, cracks the whip and tells people, here's what you got to do. But a leader gets in front and says, hey, y'all, come this way. This is where we've got to go. And we'll show people the way to go. There's a big difference there, isn't there? And I know in many places, in industry and in community and places such as that, I mean, a leader gets a whole lot more done than a boss does. I mean, it just works that way. Nehemiah provided direction. And it just seems to me in many ways that Nehemiah, you know, was a motivator. Nehemiah was a delegator. He could see what needed to be done, and he could ask somebody, you know, to do that. We talked some in previous lessons about Nehemiah's nighttime survey of the city. You know, when he was kind of looking things over and trying to understand what were the needs. You know, we got a huge task. How are we going to accomplish this? You know, it's kind of like with any kind of big project that has to be done. You can stand back from it and you can go, oh man, how are we going to do this? We'll never get this done. But somehow, you know, things have to be put in perspective, so to speak. What has to be done first? What's the first thing we have to do? And now, what comes next? And what comes next? And that's how work can be accomplished. But once he had a clear vision of what needed to be done, remember in the first chapter how he went to the people after he'd made a survey, he'd been there for several days, he'd looked things over, and he said, come. Let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. Because that was the word that he had got. The people of Jerusalem were in disgrace, and he's come now, and he has seen that's true. And even though he was of Jewish descent, when he said, we are in disgrace, he was the king's cupbearer. He was living in the palace. He was living pretty good. And though he felt disgrace for his people, it wasn't exactly the same as what the people were dealing with in Jerusalem. But he said, and we will no longer be in disgrace. And the people said, we will build the wall. That's just an interesting kind of series of events there. And again, kind of back to this point, Nehemiah provided direction and was able to get a positive response to that. I mean, think about it. It's been 13 years, really. If I can understand the chronology right, it's been about 13 years since anything has really been done to the wall, to the city. I mean, it's gone on for years that nothing has been happening. And so, you know, it's like, what's been going on? You know, it's like, well, what has happened for 13 years? And so here Nehemiah comes in and is trying to put a focus on the project. You know, a project is never started until there is a clear vision of what needs to be done. And in some ways, the clear vision wasn't that difficult. The walls are destroyed. We need to build new walls. In a little bit, it's like stating the obvious. Did they not see that? Well, of course they did. They knew that. And there was already leadership in town. There were already nobles, there were officers, there were priests who were there in the city. But it wasn't happening. Sometimes leadership can be inept. We've seen that, I'm sure. And sometimes there's just the need of a new leader that comes in and says, hey, we need to rebuild these walls. It's not that they didn't know that. But someone has to say, come on, it's over here. Let's get this done. And the response from that is favorable. Why? And I think this is a key point. Why was the response so favorable from the people? What are factors in that?
They recognized the need.
Nobody could deny the need. You know, it had to be done.
I think the point you're making is that Nehemiah included himself in it. He said, you know, this is something that we need to address. He's mm-hmm. including himself. He's not saying, you people haven't done this and you people haven't done that. Brethren, this is something we need to address and we need to work on this. He included himself in it.
Yes, I think so. What else? I mean, there's another factor that kind of seems to stand out, too.
Well, they didn't have authority from a recognized source.
Yes.
Artaxerxes
yes.
was with them in this program. And not
King wasn't going to fight them on this, you know, and that and that had been part, that's what stopped them before. You know, and so that's been reversed, that's been changed. But I have to believe the fact that Nehemiah was able to tell them, and because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my request. Remember that in chapter 2? I mean, they knew that this was the will of God. I mean, that should have given them just tremendous courage and desire to move forward. I mean, it's just like when we know the will of God and we know what he would have us do, that should kind of be the end of the question, shouldn't it? And now we're looking forward for answers. We're moving forward. When we know that God is with us, when we know what God's will requires, that should be the greatest motivator of us moving forward with whatever we have to do.
This is probably an obvious point, but there are apparently no miracles involved here. God can do anything he wants to do.
Sure. He didn't need men to rebuild the walls.
All options are open for God
sure.
all the time. But he uses our hands are his hands in this world. Our mouths are, you know, he uses men in order to get things done. And I think that's an important thing to remember, that if something's going to get done, and we know it's the will of God to do it, we need to just get on with it
yeah.
and do it because we are
you're right.
God's hands.
There's some things sometimes in the lives of all of us, spiritual things, that we just need to get on with it and get it done. You know, we can see deficiencies in our lives. We can see the walls that are tore down. And we just need to get on with rebuilding the walls and moving on because that's what God would have us do. It's interesting to me here in the text, you know, as you kind of go through the chapter, you know, one of our points, someone needs to lead. Nehemiah led by example, and soon others appeared And as you go through the chapter, there's at least 7, 8, or 9 different men that are mentioned. Rephaniah in verse 9, leader of the half district of something. I forget what it was. There was a lot of leaders like that in Shalom and Micaiah and another Shalom and another Nehemiah, you know, who are leaders of the half district of Jerusalem, the half district of this area over here. Leaders that came and are called out. And that's why I say I'm not exactly sure who is in charge of organizing everything around the wall, but I got a feeling that some of these leaders came, and maybe there were some who were a part of their district, and they were as well saying, come on, let's build this section of the wall. And it's just a point to be made that there were other leaders. It wasn't just Nehemiah. There were others who stepped up in the responsibility. And the point it begs to be made that leaders have to lead. Again, we're back to the point we made a moment ago. It's easy for someone to say, well, I'm a leader, or I'm in charge here, and then provide no direction for where others need to go. That's not leadership. You know, someone has to say, you know, we're going this way. Here's the question. Something for us to consider for just a few minutes. What provisions are made for leadership in the New Testament church? We're trying to make some application. We're studying Nehemiah, and you can walk away going like, oh, what does this mean to me? Well, there's some application we can make. You know, we're talking about provisions for the leadership in the New Testament church.
I think the point that was made about the nobles who didn't help, they were, the people had looked at them in a different for years. They were supposed to be the leaders.
Uh-huh.
But it was obvious that they saw someone else come in wanting to do something. It wasn't their idea. It wasn't that they weren't able to do things, but they did not want to be a servant. The New Testament teaches us that those that are going to be leaders have to serve.
Mm-hmm.
They're willing to do whatever it takes, mm-hmm, according to what God commands.
Proven servants.
Yeah, and I see a parallel between this situation when John the Baptist and Jesus came, and there was these so-called leaders in the Jewish community who didn't want to give up, didn't want to serve God, so they rebelled against that. They tried to stop the building of the faith and the building of the walls and their faith toward Jesus.
Yeah. Leaders who were not leaders for God, really and truly. I guess you have to say they were still leaders, but not in a good way, not for the right thing. And so,
position.
That's right. Looking for position. That's right. We're kind of back to that. I'm the leader here. I'm in charge, but really not, and really ought not be, kind of a thing. Okay. More discussion on what provisions are made for leadership in the New Testament church. I mean, there's a point that can be made that we are all to be servants. Right? What about other leadership? What do we see?
In the very early stages of the church, provisions of leadership were apostles,
mm-hmm,
and prophets.
Mm-hmm.
We no longer have apostles, but they've all died off. Prophecy was fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
Those men have died off. But there are still provisions for leadership.
True.
Elders, preachers, teachers.
Yeah. You know, Ephesians chapter 4 becomes a proof text of the fact that Christ has provided for the church direction and leadership, you know, for a specific reason even. And our time's going to go away here in about a second. But make a little note there on your paper, Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. And Titus chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. Okay, if you see the red writing there, what provisions are made for leadership in the New Testament church? Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. And Titus chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. And God willing, next time, let's take up right here at this point and kind of work our way forward. We've made most of the points, I think, to be made already in chapter 3, but we'll kind of work through the rest of this page a little bit because there's some other points we need to make. But then make sure you pick up in the back, lesson 5 is ready. And you need to get that. And we'll work into that next time too. I appreciate your good comments. Good comments. And I appreciate so much y'all moving up. You don't have to run to the back now, you know, for a seat. You can stay up here in the front. Thank you all.